equal to the pioneering flying career of one of the country's earliest aviators, Oscar Gaden, who only took to the skies after a chance remark that he should learn to fly. In Oscar Gaden, A Tale of One Man's Love of Flying, his daughter, Dr. Anna Maria Gaden, takes a personal look at both her father's lone adventures, as well as his becoming chief pilot of Teal, the forerunner of Air New Zealand during the flying boat era. Oscar Gaden died in 1991, aged 93. He was the fifth and the youngest pilot to navigate a solo journey between England and Australia on a plane called Kia Ora. And he won the first blind flying trophy in the UK. That's flying with a hood over the cockpit. Why would? Well, anyway, his many adventures took him all over the world, including Africa and the Middle East. Dr. Anna Maria Gaden spent the early years of her working life as an economist with Treasury in New Zealand and the UK, and is the author of six books in the field of management psychology. She says right from his early adult life, there were clues about her father's adventurous spirit.
It wasn't until after his mother and father had separated. His father had decamped to New Zealand, and his mother followed 4 years after to try and get some desperately needed money from him. And at that point, Dad sort of showed his independence and his sort of entrepreneurial flair by taking off and doing some rabbiting, earning enough money from that to open a cycle shop in Spraydon, in the South Island. And then from there, hopped to opening a garage. He didn't know anything about cars, but he opened a garage anyway. And that was in Southbridge, just south of
Christchurch. Yeah, he's a Cantabrian.
And then he pocketed his money and hopped off to Sydney and opened a garage there and a car hire firm. And he stayed there for about 1.5 years. And then he thought, well, I'll go across to London and see my relatives and have a bit of holiday. But on the way there, he came across this guy who said to him, have you ever thought of flying? And he said, no. And then he started thinking about it. And he, by the time he got to London, he had decided to learn to fly. So right from quite an early age, he's sort of showing a real adventurous spirit.
And practical, can-do,
yes,
action-taking stuff attached to it,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly.
So at the time where he was travelling, where was flying at?
Well, it was pretty much based on adventurous heroes doing some, you know, dashing flights here, there and everywhere. I mean, this was in about 1929-30 we're talking about, and his flight was in 1930. Just before his flight, Kingsford Smith had and several others had tried to break Hinkler's record, which was 15 days from England to Australia. And there was a host of them trying to break that record at around the time Dad was being trained. But that was sort of like the big event in flying at the time, was that race to get down to Australia.
It's an irony, isn't it, that he's on board a passenger ship bound for England when he's,
yes,
when he's having these conversations.
It is, isn't it?
So the book includes around 20 original pages of Oscar's logbooks.
Yes.
And how did this help you piece together his flying adventures from the beginning?
Well, it did. I mean, when I was piecing together the story of his flight from England to Australia, I mean, the logbooks were absolutely invaluable to do that. And I think he himself really loved his logbooks. They were precious to him. So it was very important to put them in. And I think people who are interested in aviation love the logbooks anyway. But it's just a very interesting historical record, I think, of the way people flew in those days, you know. So I think that it helped me a great deal to have the logbooks at hand.
So let's talk about that momentous 1930 flight, a solo journey between England and Australia. It's,
yes,
not a particularly glamorous affair, is it?
It isn't glamorous, no, but it was... It was rather romantic, according to some of the newspaper articles, after he'd finished and got to Australia. But at the beginning, I think quite a few of the newspapers thought he was stark raving mad, because he had only just learnt to fly. This was the significance of his flight compared with, say, Bert Hinkler or Kingsman Smith. The latter two had years of flying experience, and he had had 12 hours 55 to get his A license, after which he could go solo, and then he had 40 hours flying after that, practicing landing and things like that.
That was it? That was all he'd
That was all he had, you see. So he said, he admitted afterwards, once he got back to New Zealand, he said, you know, I really can't fly an aeroplane. But at the time, he was just determined to do it his way. And he was a very determined man. And so he went and bought this plane from the owner of Selfridges in London. His son had an aeroplane and got bored with it. So the father was selling it. And so they advertised it in a magazine called Flight. And Dad saw it and walked into the department store and said, I want to buy the aeroplane. And then they said, well, you'd better go up and have a test drive of this thing. And so he did. He came back down and they sold it to him for 450 quid plus his motor car. So off he went, you know, flying up and down Britain. And the main reason to fly from England to Australia is because he would get bored if he just flew round and round England, which is what everyone else did once they got their A licence and wanted to get to their commercial licence. They just did something that he regarded as totally boring. So he refused to do it. And I don't think he really realised what he was in for, I have to admit.
Well, let's talk about that. So it's a de Havilland DH-60 Gypsy Moth that he buys and that he flies in. And just describe that as best you can. Again, we're not talking about a fancy machine, not for a distance like this.
It was 23 feet long, 7 metres long, which is not that long. It was a tiny plane. And I think it could do about 800 miles in a day, which wasn't that much to keep up with someone like Kingsford. You know, Dad would have had to do about 1,200 miles a day to keep up with Kingsford, who had a much more powerful plane. So he started when unfortunately there was fog. He had said he would only fly if the weather was good. The weather wasn't good, and he still flew. And he had to come down in the fog. He left from Croydon, and he came down somewhere in Kent, and he stayed the night, and then left very, very early. He had done the same thing when he was leaving from Croydon, because he didn't want anyone to stop him, so he left before the authorities would be out of bed. And so he left at about 6 o'clock in the morning. He did the same thing from Lumpt, and he went to Munich. And when he was there, he had a disaster that almost wrecked the whole flight, because he was turning the propeller to start the engine, and the throttle had been left on, and he always denies that he left the throttle on. He says one of the crowd must have leant in and played with it or something, and it's quite possible they did, because the crowds were all around his plane. But anyway, when that happens, the plane just goes round and round in circles and just kind of wrecks itself. So he thought, well, we'd better stop this, or it's the end of the flight. And so two Germans helped him, and eventually they subdued the plane, and he put the throttle in. And he had been run over by a tyre of the airplane at some point, so a doctor was saying, well, you shouldn't really carry on. And he says to the newspaper people, well, I was really lucky there. And I think I put it in italics in the book, because he was always saying things like that. He'd have some disaster and then he'd say, well, that was lucky. And he doesn't say, oh, that was unlucky that the throttle was out. His mind isn't fashioned like that. He's much more of an optimist.
He sees the space, not the obstacle in the way.
Yes, that's exactly what he's doing. And he does it all the way down, even with some worse disasters than that. He's sort of, well, aren't I lucky, he says.
So it's
and I'm on my way, he says. This is from Munich. I'm on my way now. And so it's good. I've got some experience under my belt. And so he carries on to the next adventure. And so it goes on.
We should say it's an open cockpit plane.
Oh, now, yes.
It's 18 days to travel to Australia. Where are the main stops along the way?
The main stops, well, they're all pretty main stops. I mean, he has to refuel along the way. I suppose one would be a main stop in India, where he landed in a bog, basically. The air ministry had given him the wrong directions. He lands in a bog, the plane turns over, he has to sort of crawl out backwards And he took the wing off right at the plane and then put the wing back on. And all the locals were around trying to help him. So they waited until the next morning till it was light. And then they dragged it about 2 miles to get to a field that he could fly from. And when he got to Calcutta, where he stayed for a day just to make sure the plane was all right, I mean, that was the same kind of thing, saying, oh, boy, I was really lucky there. So that was a main stop. And another main stop was probably in Bima in Indonesia. This was the stop before the hop across to Australia. And he was inspecting the engine, which he normally did his own maintenance at the end of each flying day. And he found that 2 valve springs and 2 valves had gone. And that was about all of the spares he had been able to afford to take with him on his flight. And they'd both gone, so he replaced them. If they had gone mid-flight, he would have been down in the middle of the ocean. And he also used to say, when he was flying across the Timor Sea, he would say, this is the worst part of the whole trip was flying across the Timor Sea, because if the plane comes down in the ocean, you've had it. And the reason you've had it is because there's so many sharks in the sea. And he always used to swore black and blue that there were more sharks in the Timor Sea than any other sea in the world. And I used to hoot laughing at this, saying, there are not, Dad. And he would swear that, yes, this was the why he was so afraid of flying that stretch to Australia.
What do you make of his personality now, reflecting on it? There's the clear can-do.
Yes.
You wouldn't describe it as a recklessness, because he wouldn't have lived to 93, I think he was, wasn't
93,
he?
93, yes.
So what, reflecting on these things that he says to you, what is it? I mean, there's a childlike adventure to this, but when you reflect on him as he was at this time, pre his, you know, professional flying career, how do you reflect on it?
On him in these times, or in his professional flying career?
At this time, how do you reflect on his attitude and his approach to all this?
Well, I think he is born an optimist. I think he's also very impetuous and impulsive, and that's part of his character as well. And I think he stayed like that. He was very bold. He was very ambitious, and I think he's always been quite ambitious as well. I think all of those three traits carry him through on this flight from England to Australia, as they do for, you know, another 20 years or so. I think you see the same traits in him. I don't think he's reckless, because he's very intelligent. So he's got
managed his risk, should we call it?
Well, I think he's a risk taker, yes.
Well, we must finish this extraordinary achievement. I think he was the fifth to complete this flight. Is that correct?
Yes, he was the fifth.
The final leg
was to Wyndham to Sydney. Well, that was worse than the trip over from England to Australia. I mean, he went across from the west side to the east side of Sydney in this teeny little plane. And he's used to looking out for navigational sites like railway lines and things like that. And, of course, when he's flying from Wyndham to Alice Springs via Halls Creek, I think his was the first to have actually done that, and that everyone thought he was crazy doing that. He plots out his path very, very carefully, and he's using his little compass all the time. It's his mainstay, it's his little compass. That's apart from putting his head over the side of the aeroplane and following whatever railway lines there are. But the hop from Halls Creek to Alice Springs didn't have any railway lines he could follow, so he's just reliant on his little compass. And he is sussing it out, even though everyone around him thinks, you're not going to make it. And he does make it. He makes it every time.
How much fuel was left in the tank, however, by the time he landed?
I don't actually know. I've never asked him that one. He's never said.
Was he ecstatic when he arrived? How did he describe his feelings when he achieved it?
When he achieved the flight to to Wyndham or to Sydney, it's about the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
Was he ecstatic? No, I would say he's not that kind of personality to get ecstatic. He was definitely relieved. I mean, by the time he got to Broken Hill on the way to Sydney, he describes himself having been given a glass of beer, and he is so relieved to have made it to Broken Hill. And he thinks to himself, well, I've absolutely cracked it now. I've got to Broken Hill and I've got a glass of beer. That's it. There's nothing more to prove. You know, I've done it. That was just before he got to Sydney. And I think it was getting over the hump of Alice Springs, which was the worst part of the whole trip all the way from England. And so he then makes it to Sydney, and he makes it on time. He's supposed to get there at 3 o'clock, and he gets there at 2:56. And so when he's telling me these tales, he always tells me how close he was to 3 o'clock. He's kind of focused on some very matter-of-fact kind of practical things, which is how he survives and is so successful.
Anna Maria Garden is our guest. We're talking about the exploits, the achievements of her father, Oscar Garden, who was the fifth person to fly from the UK to Australia, and most remarkably, with very few hours of flying time before he undertook the venture in 1930. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. Let's talk about what happens after this achievement there, because he does go into a professional flying
yes.
career. And how did that begin?
Well, it began partly when he was in Africa. He had started a Skyworks thing with business with a guy called John Trainham, who was a parachutist, and it was a disaster. And so he decides to try and break the Cape down to London record. Doesn't succeed. He crashes in the jungle and spends months fixing the plane. And it was at that time he starts writing letters to his mother saying, I want a regular job. You know, can you see if you can get me a regular job? And so his mum tries in New Zealand. But he's sort of got half his mind on it while he's joyriding up through Africa once the plane is fixed to Palestine. And he's still joyriding, but he's got it in the back of his head that he really wants a regular job. So he goes back to London and is broken, close to starvation for about 7 or 8 months. And then he gets a job out of the blue by a company called United Airlines, a new company. And they have asked him, because they were involved in the Skyworks arrangement with the Spartan aircraft that they used in Skyworks, and that's how they got hold of Dad. So they offered him a job, and that was his first step into being a career pilot, was in United Airlines, which ran routes internal to England, if you put it that way, and then extending to Scotland after a while.
Well, based in London, he joins British Airways and Imperial
yes.
Airways, flying boats.
United Airlines was merged into with four other airlines into British Airways.
I see.
So, and then British Airways begins 1st of January 1936, and he stays on the internal routes for a while, and then he starts on the European route. So he goes to Stockholm, to Malmo, to Hamburg, Hanover, Copenhagen, and then to Paris. And he's flying all these different machines, and there's all sorts of scrapes and that on those planes. But eventually he hears that there's going to be a Trans-Tasman service with a flying boat. And this, of course, is what he sets his heart on. And so he jumps ship and goes to Imperial Airways, who fly flying boats, and he gets trained with them. So he is then flying what they call the S-23s and the S-30s, great big flying boats all around the Imperial Airways routes down to Karachi.
He's very strategic on that front, isn't he?
What?
He's very strategic on that front then.
Yes, extremely. But he is very canny. He's very intelligent.
Mm.
It's exactly right. He wanted to get back to New Zealand primarily, and his family were there. And he wanted to keep some kind of regular job. So that's why he's jumping to the flying boats.
What's so interesting about his story, of course, is that it documents, just as you have, the early years of commercial airlines in Britain and now
yeah.
in New Zealand. And he comes to be chief pilot and manager at the country's first airline, Tasman Imperial Airways Limited, or TEAL. What is the story that he tells about this happening?
Well, he would say it was down to really hard work. I mean, he's a very determined person as well. He's also a very good pilot, and I think he knows that he's a good pilot. So how that happened was John Burgess was the first down with the Aotearoa flying boat, and then he left in 1943, the beginning of 1943, to go and join VOAC again. And Dad was promoted to the chief pilot at that time, and then in the same year he was promoted to operations manager. So I think he would have regarded it as something that gives him an opportunity to do the things that he wants to do with the airline, and I think he was very good. The commentators certainly describe him in quite flowery terms. His skill at doing those two roles.
Well, let's talk about the formation of New Zealand's first regular Trans-Tasman air service. The first crossing, I understand, was gruesome. What do we know of it?
The first crossing. Not much that I know about the first crossing. They're the ones, you mean the two, Catherine, where they lost their life?
Well, this is Charles Kingford Smith, Charles.
Oh, their one. Yes. That was gruesome. It was 14 hours going over from Sydney to Auckland. And then on the way back, it was something like 23 hours. I mean, that was gruesome. So, but the point, what they were trying to demonstrate, Kingsford Smith and his and crew, were that it was viable to have a link between Sydney and Australia. This is something that the governments had been nitpicking about. And it was up to the intrepid adventurers like Kingsford Smith to prove that it actually was viable. So after they'd made this return crossing, they made several more crossings just to keep rubbing in the point, you know, that this was a viable operation. And they had wanted to be part of the solution, you know, well, be part of the airline that eventually was set up that flew between Sydney and Auckland, but that wasn't to be for various reasons. Kingsford Smith lost his life while those negotiations were going on, and so it basically, with the stubbornness of the New Zealand government and the Australian government, it basically fell through. But in the meantime, some of the British politicians were, and Imperial Airways were, discussing the idea of extending the route from Qantas routes across to New Zealand. And that is what happened in the end. They had a British and Australian and New Zealand representatives on the committee, and they got to an agreement eventually. It took a while, and it took a lot of prodding from other people, like the newspaper media. And eventually they were agreed, and they got the flying boats from Imperial Airways Reserve for New Zealand.
You describe his years at TEAL and the several chapters in the book on them as his favourite years and historically significant. And in what ways were they? In many ways, were they?
Well, they were historically significant because this really was the age of aviation when we were starting with TEAL. This is like 39 with getting the agreement and John Burgess down to New Zealand, and 40 when Dad was bringing the Awarua down. I mean, those are the years that really were the age of aviation for organisations and civil authorities. So you have the prospect, if New Zealand doesn't have these two flying boats, you have the prospect of New Zealand sort of being left out in the cold and being left behind from what's going on in the rest of the world. So it was terribly important that they have this airline. And I think that was one of the things that appealed to Dad about it, why it was some of his favourite years, was because he wanted to get New Zealand to be in a strategic place vis-a-vis the rest of the world. And I think the other thing that is important to remember is that he was very interested in the US link. Now, some of the people involved with the airlines were focusing mostly on the Empire and the British politicians, but Dad and Colonel Fowler, who was the chairman of the board of directors, also had a lot of interest in extending the teal's reach up to America, to the Pacific coast anyway. And so that was an important step forward for New Zealand, I think, to take, to be focusing on what was commercially viable, not just what was politically motivated.
What of the politics? Because he had his battles, didn't he, with the government over things like what kind of planes to have. What was the issue between the new flying boats and the land planes? What was that discussion about?
That discussion was around the fact that the flying boats were very hard to pressurise them, and the land planes were coming on stream and they were pressurised, which means that they could fly above the weather. And the flying boats could only do so with tremendous difficulty. They could get up to 10 or 12,000 feet rather than, say, 23,000, 35,000 feet. So what does that matter? Well, for the trip from Sydney to Auckland, it mattered because the weather was such a problem. It was all right having flying boats flying around from Athens, you know, down to Karachi or something in small, short hops. But Sydney to Australia was a long hop, and it mattered that the weather was so disruptive to the airline. So that was the main problem that Dad had with going with pressurised land planes. I think also just thinking of the airline competitively, you needed to have land planes to compete with the other airlines across the world, who after the war were all gearing up themselves up with the pressurised land planes.
What happened when his flying days were over? He lived to a good age. I sort of envisage him now as probably flying till he's about 92 and a half. But what did happen to bring his flying days to an end, and what did he do afterwards?
Well, what brought them to an end was one of his impulsive decisions. I don't think he should ever have left flying, but he did. And that was because the British government insisted to the New Zealand government that we loan for Sandringham's, five as it turned out. And we should replace the Awarua and the Aotearoa with these Sandringhams, which would be just a temporary measure before we got the Solents through, which would have been in 1949. And their decision was based on the idea that we buy from Britain rather than buy from America, whereas Dad knew that there were plenty of Boeings being sold from America at that time that were very, very cheap and would have been much better to buy. So he got into a big wrangle with them over that particular decision. I think also there was the difference between him and some of the masters that came after him, over him, when the war had ended. So he started to get people surrounding him in his little baby airline that were full of rules and regulations, and they were from the defence forces in the war. And so, of course, they had pride of place to join a company like Teal. But Dad wasn't a rules and regs kind of person. He was based on professionalism and operational excellence, but not on rules and regs. And I think all in all, the whole lot got too much for him. And he just said, well, that's it, I'm going, you know, in one of his impulsive decisions, and he left.
And spent many years as a horticulturalist, I understand.
Yes, he did spend the next years as a horticulturist. Till he retired, he was a horticulturist, yes.
What was the influence of the way he lived his life on you? I am intrigued that you've worked as a... you've written books on management psychology. I find that really interesting. But what was the influence of the way he lived his life on you?
He's made me phenomenally determined and also very self-disciplined, very hard-working. Those are the three main qualities I have from him. I think also from knowing how he reacted once he wasn't flying, it's also been very important for me to find out what my real bent is, what is my thing. And with me, it's organisational behaviour or management psychology. That's the thing that I have found that is true to my soul. And for Dad, what's true for his soul is flying. And so it was always very important for me that I find that.
Anna Maria Garden there, with the story of her father, Oscar Garden, and his tale is told in Oscar Garden, A Tale of One Man's Love of Flying.